It's another Monday and another episode of The Inadequate Life, the podcast about the creative process and people whose lives depend upon it. On today's episode, one of Canada's busiest actresses, Shalina Kennedy. She's performed on stage at the Shaw Festival, the Stratford Festival, and Broadway. Tony Award-winning director Des McAniff called her the most gifted musical theater actress he'd come across in many, many years. Currently, Shalina's at the Charlottetown Festival, starring in the debut of Ted Dykstra's new musical, Evangeline. I interviewed Shalina at Soul Pepper Theater in Toronto. We talked about her experiences on stage and off. We talked about everything from the time she lost her voice on stage to what it felt like when she was on Broadway and Jesus Christ Superstar closed. We even talk about food. Yeah, she went through a period where she ate a lot of liver. That's all coming up on The Inadequate Life. Hey, thanks for listening today. Settle in, get comfortable. This episode goes a little longer than the other ones have. I tend to listen to podcasts on my mobile with my headphones. You know, I'll lie on the couch, get really comfy. You know, like instead of watching television, we don't have actually cable at home. So I tend to listen to a fair amount of podcasts. Sometimes I listen when I'm cooking. I'll just have the earbuds on while I'm cooking. And remember, you can listen in your car. So if you're driving to Stratford or driving to the Charlottetown Festival, download it off the site and you can listen to it in your car if you've got Bluetooth or a player. And wherever you are, I think you're going to enjoy the chat with Shalina. First, though, I have to tell you about my weekend. Oh my gosh, it was crazy. We had this amazing, really, really severe storm. Unbelievable winds and hail. And a huge tree in our backyard went down, got pushed down by the winds and the trees. No one was hurt, thank goodness. But there was damage to the neighbor's roof, which was awful because they're in the process of trying to sell their house. And literally the corner of their roof got chipped and the gutter and the eavesdrop. It was just horrible. Horrible. And the fence, of course, like huge parts of the fence all went down. So it was just that kind of a, you know, catch up Friday, Saturday, Sunday. And, you know, the three guys came with the trucks, the tree removal service. What a job those guys did. Amazing. Climbing up the trees with ropes and pulleys and chainsaws and just cutting a huge piece of the tree and guiding it down gently. Unbelievable. I mean, then the pieces of the tree falling down weighed more than the guy holding onto the rope. It was unbelievable how they managed to make that work. They had the chipper shredder once they got all the brush down, going through the chipper shredder. I haven't seen one of those since I last watched the movie Fargo. Remember that? Oh, God, that was all I could think of as the stuff, you know, the brush was going into the chipper shredder. That thing could just so easily take someone's life. Anyway, hard work, and the guys did a great job. But then, you know, I started looking around at what was left, and all of a sudden we had this awful, empty backyard, so we decided to spruce up the garden, Susie and I. We went out on Sunday and bought a bunch of perennials, and then, of course, oh, we got to get those in so they don't dry up. And it probably wasn't the best idea to do this at the end of a long, very stressful weekend. You know, we had the insurance adjusters and just the neighbors, you know, because they wanted to show the house, a little bit of tension there. So when it came time to planting the flowers in the garden, I definitely wasn't as patient as I should have been with Susie. And, you know, I was just tense, which is terrible because there really shouldn't be tension in the garden. And poor Susie, who, you know, isn't, I mean, neither of us are great gardeners, but she knows less than I do. So it was not, it was just too bad. You know, I got a little angry and I wasn't as patient as I should have been. And, you know, that happens in the theater. I mean, you know, Shalina talks about some actors in the interview. She talks about actors getting tense during the rehearsal process and all the tension about, you know, getting the show up on time. And in one case, an actor who was throwing things around. That's awful. You know, fortunately, it's my experience that there isn't as much of that as there used to be. And that kind of behavior, which might have been more common in the theater or in the music world a few decades ago, isn't tolerated as much as it used to be. And I'd say that's a good thing. You know, the creative process should not be driven by fear or physical intimidation. To me, that's just a zero-sum game. You know, in the long run, no one wins. No one wins when that kind of stuff happens. So onward and upward. And that's what it's all about. You know, the podcast is there to remind you that the creative process is difficult and there are going to be mistakes and things are going to fall by the wayside. Not everything's going to work, but we have to try. So before we get to the interview with Shalina, I just want to remind you, Karen Hartwick at Tea Leaves in Stratford is a sponsor of the show. As always, I try to sample a little bit of tea. I've got some, it smells so good. You can hear me smelling that, eh? This is called Hibiscus Heart Tea. And it's, this is the leaves here I have, but I'm also drinking it cold, which is perfect for the hot summer. And I don't know if you saw this in the news last year, but apparently drinking 3 cups of hibiscus tea a day can lower your blood pressure. So if you're stressed out, as I was, or you have, you know, an interest in lowering your blood pressure and are into that sort of thing, you might want to look it up on the internet or ask your doctor about hibiscus tea. And anyway, if even, I mean, this is just great. This stuff, ice, a little bit of hibiscus heart tea with some honey, perfect for a hot summer day. So thanks, Karen. You can buy the tea if you're in Stratford, or you just go to stratfordtealeaves.com. And all the selections are there. You can buy online or just give her a call and order. So thanks for listening. And thanks to the folks at Soul Pepper Theater in Toronto for generously giving me the space to interview Shalina. I really hope you enjoy it. And yeah, thanks again for listening. Here comes my interview with Shalina Kennedy. So I read about your background, and you just mentioned your father. And I'm intrigued, and forgive me if I'm reading something wrong, but your father was a brigadier general, military guy.
Yep.
And the portrait that I get of your mother was almost hippie-ish. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, she was quite a hippie. Yep.
So how did that happen? I'm guessing peace-loving hippie hook up with a brigadier general?
Well, you know what's interesting about, well, this is just an interesting character study in general, my parents, because they're fascinating people. And their story is really something that should be a movie, because they've known each other since they were in grade 4.
Wow.
They grew up 2 streets away from each other, and I don't think they'll mind me telling the story, but they used to walk to school together, and they were in the same class.
Oh, that's so sweet.
I know, it just makes me just, you know, melt. I think when they were in high school, they dated for a while. And, you know, my mom was always, she claims to have been hopelessly in love with my father since day one. And then she always says that she begged him to marry her. But my dad's story is always that, you know, he was in love with her from the beginning. So it's, you know, who do you believe?
Right.
And then they got married at 23 at City Hall in Toronto. And my mom was, you know, wearing a black wig and a mini dress, and she got kicked out of the judge's office for smoking.
Oh, that's very cool.
But they had a great life together. And the funny thing is that they've known each other for 50 years. But my dad, I mean, everybody's view of a military man is very specific, but my dad is a poet, and he's a writer, and he's an artist. He does watercolors, and he's a peace-loving man. I mean, we get this idea that military people are violent, you know, conservatives. Yeah. And they're not. I mean, they're not all like that. You know, my dad is a great example. He's a huge animal rights activist, and he was the CEO of, or the administrator for, the Green Party in Brockville for a long time. So he does all sorts of things that are very left.
Sure.
And my mom is very interesting. She did some acting for a long time. She's a singer. So.
Yeah, and it speaks to people's assumptions about military people.
Absolutely.
That's exactly how that comes in. But you read that and you go, okay, there's something going on there for sure.
And he did a lot of peacekeeping too. You know, when I was growing up,
that's what the Canadian forces did. I mean, it's changing, sadly, but that really was the Canadian military's role around the world. It was to go and be peacekeepers. And so, you know, that's, you can't knock that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
And so, I mean, you traveled around. So you were a military brat. You traveled around a lot?
Yep. All over Canada and Australia for 2 years, and England when I was very small for 2 years.
Huh. And what was the longest you'd stay in one place?
I think the longest we had was 3 years in Winnipeg when I was a little girl. Mm-hmm. And then my parents made it a rule that I would finish high school in Kingston. So even though my dad got posted down to the States, my mom and I stayed on so I could finish high school.
Huh.
So I was there for 4 years. And we changed houses once, and I changed high schools once, but we were still in the same city for four years.
So is Kingston home for you? Does that feel like home?
It feels, it sort of feels like home. Winnipeg sort of feels like home too, because my parents are from there, and so much of my family is from there. And then also now Stratford feels like home, because that's where I have my house. So I sort of have 3 homes.
You got a house in Stratford. Like, when are you going to be there next?
I don't know.
That's kind of be a little weird. Yeah. So and it's great. Well, I spent some time. I love Winnipeg. I lived there for a couple of years. I worked for CBC there. And it's a great theater town, too.
It is. It is a great theater
town. Have you had a chance to perform there?
No. And that's the ironic thing, is I've always wanted to go back, especially because all of my family's there, and I'd love to be able to stay, you know, to be there for a time and get to know my cousins again.
And then do you think that life of moving around and developing a clan and then being close with your parents, because they were the core, has been helpful for you as an actress? Because, I mean, a lot of them, you know, you're traveling around a lot. right?
Huge. And in fact, you know, before when we were talking about sort of milestones and changes in you know, or moments of kind of importance in my life, one of them was when I realized that I was sort of not addicted to this lifestyle, but that it was in my blood, that I had been doing this my whole life, and I don't really know any other way of life.
When did that occur to you?
A few years ago. And then again in New York City when I was... You know, it was tough for me to leave New York City. Now we're jumping ahead, but because I developed a community there,
and I
kind of fell in love with it.
And I bet there was a strong community of, you know, you're all of a sudden world class. You know, it's a whole different level.
Yeah, and it's never just you anyway. You know, I think, I can't remember who taught me this. I think it was Gary Griffin when I was doing West Side Story. It became really clear that there was no individual performance. Like, I can't exist on my own. I can only, Maria is only Maria because of Tony and because of her family and because, and then you get, you know, the it's such a collaborative art form that nobody exists as an island.
Yeah, yeah.
So you're only where you are because of other people.
Yeah.
So it's, I mean, I could never ever take any credit solely based on my own efforts.
Sure.
It's always because of other people.
So how was it working with Gary Griffin at West Side Story? That was, I saw the show twice. I loved it so much. I went back. I'm like,
great.
It was just outstanding. It really, really, everything about it, as you said, it just was solid and just put together beautifully, you know? It was an amazing piece of work. So how was it working with Gary Griffin?
It was phenomenal. I mean, I just think he's brilliant. And I don't mean that people use that word all the time, but I really think he is very special and he's so intelligent and he's got so much heart and he thinks outside the box and he re-envisions everything he touches. It's always got that Gary Griffin stamp. And I just feel lucky that I got a chance to do that particular production with him, because he had a very close relationship to it and he really wanted to do it. I love working with directors when they're so passionate about what they're working on.
Yeah.
You know, you feel like you're in something really special.
And did you work with Gary Griffin before you worked with Des McAnuff, or had you worked with Des prior to Gary?
No, we worked together at the same time. So I was doing Forum with Des the same season that I was doing.
Yeah, that's right, I remember. Okay, I got
West Side Story.
Yeah, so and this is what I read this, that Des said this about you, and I love this quote. He said, "Chelina Kennedy, simply put, is the most gifted musical theater actress I've come across in many, many years.
Okay.
She's a great comedian as well as a terrific dramatic actor." That's from Des McAnuff.
Oh, that's very nice.
It's amazing praise from Des. And one of the things I love about it is that he recognizes your sense of humor. Because I saw him for him. Funny thing happened. I went home, and you were great. It was
thanks.
You were having so much fun. Everyone was having. Again, you know, the Stephen we met, the whole gang, Bruce Dowd. It was just a fun, fun show. And do you feel like you get, well, people talked about that in your Maria, that your Maria was more sort of playful than other people had maybe done it. How do you ever get frustrated that you can't bring out that sense of humor? Because you're often playing very serious, heavy, intense women, you know?
Yeah. Well, I don't know. I think it's great to be able to work with people who, you know, like Des is, a brilliant, brilliant person. And director and visionary. And so, you know, you just kind of, you run with whatever, you know, if you trust the person who is leading you, then you run with whatever it is that they're about. You know, you sort of open yourself to doing it their way. And he was he's all about making it a safe room and allowing you to just play. And some of the stuff is going to suck. It's going to be bad. And it doesn't matter. You know, you have to be brave enough to try it and to trust that he's going to say that's good or lose that.
And had you done comedy that broad before? A funny thing? Because it was broad.
Yeah, I had done some at Shaw.
Okay.
And I guess I was nervous that I was sort of going to be pigeonholed as this, you know, the blonde bimbo, you know, character, because I'd done this, you know, which I loved. I was sort of getting mildly addicted to it because I played Lydia in The President, who was sort of a Marilyn Monroe character. And it was so much fun and very, very broad. And so I sort of took a version of that and discovered who my Philia was from that.
Yeah, it worked. And then, so in talking about directing, so now I'll take a quote that you talked about, Des. You said, in describing Des McAnuff's directing style, you said, just as you said now, he's very collaborative, open-minded.
Mm.
So, and now you've worked, you know, with tons of directors. How do you get around directors who aren't as collaborative with their actors? Because now you're coming into the situation, and they're maybe not as collaborative, as open-minded, because you've worked with the top directors in North America.
Well, I think the biggest thing that actors have to strive for and sometimes fight for is their own voice in the room, you know? And and so I think when you're working with a really good director, that just happens naturally where you have a dialogue.
How do you
get
around the ones that aren't as open to that?
Well, so I guess it's tough sometimes to get around the ones who don't. I mean, I don't know. There's no real sort of easy answer to that. Yeah. Well, you got to, you know, and that's the great thing about Stratford is they've got these wonderful coaches who coach on many levels. They do breath coaching and voice coaching and, you know, and acting coaching. But they also do, you know, part of breath coaching is figuring out where you're at and where you need, you know, how, yeah. like they help you to calm down.
Absolutely.
They help you to
yeah.
deal with stressful yeah. situations. Yeah. You know, the worst story for me actually was when I had to be ushered off stage in Evita. And this is something that I just still feel horrible about, but my voice stopped working. I had worked for 2 weeks in a row without a day off because we were flown to Parliament in the middle or on the day off to sing for
Canada Day or
no, we were singing for Minister of Finance. Okay. I think we were doing a presentation, you know.
Sure.
And anyway, so with the flying and the all of the singing and doing the 8 shows a week, and that role is so demanding,
mm-hmm.
my voice just stopped on the Saturday night, I think it was a Tim Hortons weekend, like double-double. My voice just stopped, and I couldn't sing anymore.
On stage.
At sort of three-quarters of the way through the show. And I said to Juan, I was dancing with Juan at the time in the ballroom, and I said, Juan Kjorn.
Yeah.
And I said, Juan, I'm in big trouble. I don't think I can finish the show. And Rick and I, the conductor, Rick Fox, we made eye contact, and he knew something was wrong.
Wow.
So I ran off stage into my quick change, and I said, I can't go on. Get the understudy ready. And I ran on to do the big phone scene. And by the time I was done that scene, the stage manager came out. They had stopped the orchestra. She took me off stage, and my understudy went in 5 minutes later. You know, and it was terribly upsetting. I mean, for me, that was one of those breakdown moments backstage
yeah.
where I needed a little bit of assistance because you never want to stop a show partway through.
I'd say a lot of assistance if that happens. That'd be frightening.
Yeah,
yeah. This is your tool. This is what you live on.
Absolutely.
And now it's vanished.
And it's a huge amount to ask an understudy to come on at that hour, you know. And so the whole coaching team really stepped up, and Janine came into my room, and we got through it, and then they made me an immediate appointment with the, you know, with the throat specialist, and I was fine and needed just a bit of rest, and then I was back to work the next week.
The next week, a week off.
Yeah, I had a few days off, I think, but then I came back.
That's an awful story.
I know. Not my best moment, but that's okay.
And
there
to get
go.
To take a bow when that happens.
Because
the audience, I think as an audience member, I'd like to, I don't know, that's an odd situation, isn't
it? Well, it's
it?
Interesting because I talked to some people who were at that performance and they loved it. It's funny, you know, when you're an audience member, you love it when things are out of the ordinary.
Sure.
I mean, I
Something
do too.
Something happens, yeah.
You know, and the girl, Lindsay Croxall, who was understudying me, is so fabulous, and she just took up the reins and really went for it and finished the show. And so, I mean, I think she deserved that applause.
Yeah, that's true. You're right. I guess
yeah.
technically speaking, where do you? But as an audience member, you still want to show your appreciation for everything.
Yes. Yeah.
That the lead has gone through.
Yeah.
That's a great story. I've never witnessed anything like that. I've never even. That's a trip.
Yeah.
Wow. And anything? So your voice is okay now? Was it nothing permanent? No, you didn't damage.
No,
anything?
No. I was afraid that I had because I couldn't make proper sound. You know, my folds weren't meeting, so.
I'm really sensitive to that in the sense, and I haven't thought about it in musical theater because I just assume people are taken care of because you're part of a company and it's going on. But when I look at touring acts, I was just looking at going to see Lyle Lovett the other day. This is a complete tangent, but it relates to the voice. And I'll travel places to go see a show. Like I'll fly to Baltimore to go see a band if I really want or, you know, whatever. So I'm looking at Lyle's tour and he's coming to Michigan, which is not far from me, but it's the fifth night in a row. And I'm just saying, I don't think I want to go see him on the fifth night. Because that's a hard road to hoe for him, you know? I mean,
absolutely.
And I have seen him. I've seen Lyle a million times, and I love him. And nothing against him, but I just don't. I feel bad for the artist, too, because you know you need a break if you're doing that, you know? Anyway, that's a great story. Thanks for sharing that.
In fact, I kind of forgot about it until you asked me, and then I was sort of searching for a story, and I was like, oh, yeah, there's that one.
Wow. So let's. You want to move on to Jesus Christ Superstar?
Sure, yeah.
And I heard that did you listen to the album with your folks when you got the part? Is that true? Did I read that?
Yeah, I did. It's funny. I asked my parents if they would take a little trip down memory lane. So we sat in my living room in Stratford, and I've got an old record player and a whole bunch of old albums.
Yeah,
and I don't think we played the record. I think we might have played a CD that day. But anyway, we played the album from beginning to end, and I shut out all the lights, and everyone closed their eyes, and we just listened to the whole thing without speaking or anything.
As a family, I love that.
Yeah.
When I teach journalism, I talk to my students about how people used to gather around a radio and sit quietly And it was a family moment, you know. And then TV kind of did that for a while. And now TV kids, every kid has a TV in their bedroom. It's, you know, that gathering together that we do that you're talking about with your family.
Yeah.
I think we're losing that more and more. You know?
I agree. And I think it's something we need to get back.
Mm-hmm. No, and that's the beauty of theater is you're congregating all together and it's a shared experience. So there you were with your family in the dark.
Yeah.
Listening to the whole album.
With the dogs.
All the dogs. Yeah, that's right.
The four dogs.
And then I guess they must have been excited for you. So you get, and did you, who, how was the casting? Did you find out all together at the same time? Well, you all knew you were going. Yeah.
Yeah. No, well, we all found out we were going to Broadway at the same time. I mean, those of us who, I mean, there's some people who chose not to go,
sure.
Which is fair. But we all found out that there was that opportunity for us as a whole cast to go at the same moment. And it was really, really special. I mean, because most of us had never been to Broadway before.
Right.
So it was a big old debut for, I think we broke the world record for, or Broadway record for debuts with that show. I think there were 27 Broadway debuts.
And you got to meet Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice in Stratford, right? When did you first?
And also Broadway, they came in.
Were doing the show at Stratford, when did it dawn on you, this is, we're going to make it? Because there were rumors, you know, as soon as the show got mounted at Stratford, there were rumors it's going to go to Broadway. And
yeah.
you said one of your dreams was to be on Broadway. So when did you kind of go, I think this is going to work?
I just sort of felt like it was going to happen. There was no real moment, I guess, because, and Des was really great about keeping us in the loop. He, you know, even though he couldn't tell us anything official, he was saying, you know, it's looking good. And so we just had to keep the faith.
Yeah.
And it was taking a long time because I guess those sort of contracts and getting that sort of show on that scale with that many people to go to Broadway takes a long time to get the, you know, the I's dotted.
I can't imagine. And no one wants to get the actors excited in case it doesn't happen.
Exactly. And so I figured, well, Des probably wouldn't be so confident if it wasn't looking good, you know.
Right.
Not to say that was any guarantee, but...
Yeah.
You know, I felt like things are supposed to happen the way that they're supposed to happen anyway, right? So we really have no control over
those
things.
I love the way you just have this amazing, like, you are so focused in terms of the path. Do you know what I mean? Like, just listening to you talk and talking about your background and where you are now and that whole experience, like, you have this clear vision of where you're going. That's, I mean, I'm sure it's part of your success. You have to have that. You really just have to be able to go, okay, this is the way it is. This is how it's going to be.
Well, it's tough because as a, you know, I was a bit of a control freak when I was younger and I just had to surrender that,
hey,
let it go.
If I talk to someone who knows you now, will they say, she still is? Anytime anyone says when I was younger,
it's
the same.
When I was two.
Yeah.
No.
So you let some of the control freakiness go?
Yeah, I did. Well, in my 20s, especially in my early 20s.
Did you actually get therapy? How did you do that?
Well, I was a dancer for a long time, you know, and classically trained. And so with that, I think, for me, comes a lot of rigidity and I need things to be a very certain way.
Yeah.
You know, and eventually you kind of learn that you actually have absolutely no control over anything. I mean, you don't even know where you're going to live in 3 months. So why am I wasting all of this energy on something that, is completely out of my
hands.
How
did you come to that moment?
It took a long, long time. I think probably when I learned to meditate. Really, it's funny how acting and spirituality often go hand in hand. You know, because learning how to be in the moment as a character is hard.
Mm-hmm.
And learning how to be in the moment as a human being is hard. And it's kind of the same thing. You have to surrender and, you know, give yourself over to the present.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's very difficult. But I learned that, I guess, about, I don't know, maybe 8 years ago when I learned how to start being quiet.
Okay.
And I started to take mirrors away from my performance. I started to take a very different tack with what I thought was my art, my artistry, and my process. And allowed it to be a bit more raw, I guess, or less controlled. And so everything, you know, once you kind of make that shift in your being, everything else kind of drops away and you stop worrying about, like, you know, auditioning is a prime example of that. And this is what I tell kids all the time, you know, when I go into to workshop or you know, or teach. I always say that you have to go in and be present and be yourself. And it seems so trite, but it's the truth. And it's the hardest thing to do, to celebrate yourself and all of the things that make you imperfect and who you are. People want to see that.
Yeah.
They do. You think, oh, no, they don't. You know, they want to see this package that I've created.
Yeah.
But no, they don't. They actually want to see who you are. I mean, in the part, obviously. You know, but the parts
so
that
seven,
we play
seven
are
years
all,
ago, 7 years ago, you kind of had that transformation.
Yeah, I guess so. About 7 years ago.
Hmm. And no mirrors? So using less mirrors when you're
yeah, that's a
working.
Weird thing to say, but
no,
yeah.
I get it though. So when you're working through your characters, you're just
Yeah, I tried to take all the mirrors away. In fact, in West Side Story, I had a dressing room with a big mirror, and I just covered it. I asked to get a sheet so I wouldn't see it. Because when you're a dancer, I think, and when you're used to working on from the outside in, you get so distracted by how you look in the mirror and how, you know, what my hair is doing and how skinny I am and all of those things don't really matter. And you stop paying attention to what's actually going on between you and the person on stage, which is what theater is. Yeah. It's not you in the mirror. It's you and your scene partner.
So no mirror, the dressing room, no mirror. So you just go out for makeup.
Well, you know, I use like my little private mirror to get ready. But then when I'm actually warming up and doing my prep work, I do it.
And your dog, do you keep your dog backstage?
No, I wish. She would go nuts. Well, I have two of them.
Oh, okay.
They stay at home.
What kind of dogs?
I have a Portuguese water dog and a little mix.
How is that when you went from Stratford to La Jolla and then New York, were you able to take the dogs with you on tour?
Oh, that's
and not too much of a problem getting them across the border?
No problem at all, actually. I was all stressed out about that and had all their papers, but they never asked me.
They never asked you at the border.
They never even asked me one time. They were more concerned about me than they were about my pooches.
All right, so let's go back to playing the role of Mary Magdalene.
Yes.
So you said that you don't believe that Mary Magdalene was ever a prostitute, right?
Yes, and this was very hard for me when we were rehearsing the show.
How did it impact the way you approach the role?
Well, you know what Des said really helped me. He said, you know, Shalina, this is a piece of theater. This is not, well, he didn't say it's, you know.
By the tone of this, it sounds like this was an issue.
It was for me. It was for me. I mean, I was raised by a feminist hippie mom who believed that Mary Magdalene was, you know, Jesus' wife.
So was the Catholic Church part of your upbringing?
No. My parents, my mom was a little bit of a free thinker in terms of all of that. And my dad is sort of a child of Gaia. He really believes in, you know, that sort of, you know, oneness of the universe. So Mary Magdalene for me was a very strong, wealthy woman.
Mm-hmm.
And I felt it was important to try to portray her as that, especially in the show, because the show is so bare bones. I mean, it doesn't actually say that she's a prostitute. There is that indication that she's had so many men.
Right, so many men.
You know, and Judas talks briefly about her profession, but never actually names it. And so, you know, Dez's choice was to have her as a prostitute in the show. But then I was talking with some of the coaches, and one of them in particular was a feminist in the 60s, and, you know, all about women's lib. And she was saying, you know, Shalina, think about that, the idea of prostitution back in that time. I mean, women only had a couple ways to make money, and that was the main way.
It was empowering,
It was empowering, absolutely. So if she was funding this operation, you know, this movement, Jesus was the spiritual head, and she was sort of like the general manager of the company, and Jesus was the artistic director. I guess the way that I looked at it, you know, and Judas and Mary had this very controversial competitiveness, which in terms of who was the right-hand man or woman. And so that's the way I chose to look at it, and that the prostitution was not necessarily a negative thing. But, you know, when you're dealing with a story that's so popular and people have very set opinions about who she is and who Jesus is.
And yourself included, because you grew up with the music and so you had this vision of Mary Magdalene.
Definitely.
And so it sounds like it's not the way you came to the part. Or the interpretation, anyway.
I had to leave a lot of my biases at the door and just deal with what was in the script and what the unified vision is. Because, I mean, like I said, we're not...
That's exactly what... Yeah, exactly. Talks to what you said earlier about the group process and the director vision and coming through.
And, I mean, you can go in and throw fire with a certain idea. And, you know, if the other person is playing something completely different, I mean, you have to deal with what everyone is bringing to the table, not just yourself, right? So it was a great... that show was a very good lesson in letting go and surrender and not holding on to our attachments to our ideas, you know, and our beliefs. Hmm. I mean, because if I was a Catholic going into it, I'd have very set ideas of how I would want to play that character. And so, you know, and even when you do play, if like, say, if I play red, somebody might see blue. And if that's not my fault or their fault no fault involved. It's just a matter of perception and where both of us are coming from. So, that's the beauty of theater, is that it's deeply personal and it can be very different from one person to the other.
And so it worked out. It all worked out in the end, though.
Yeah,
so
it was fabulous. It was a great, one of the best theatrical experiences of my life.
Well, it must have been so fun that you, Josh, and Paul had a chance to work together before that. And you were all, I mean, I imagine, that, you know, I don't know what happened, but just the three of you just sort of managed to propel yourselves up the ladder all at the same time. It sounds like it was a really fun time for you.
It was. Yeah, it was a great time.
Yeah.
and so nice to be with friends and with people who are like family, like we were saying before. You know, the theater becomes like your family. And for all of us to do that together was very meaningful for me.
And then, but sure. It must have been so, but then it, I mean, it, I don't want to say it has a tragic ending, but so you get to Broadway, which is the pinnacle.
Yeah.
And then for reasons beyond, I mean, and then you're invested. So now you moved to New York, you rent a place, you got to sign a lease, you know, you've made all these, say goodbye to everyone and wherever you're saying goodbye to people. And I'm going, everyone's shaking your hand. Oh, this is going to be the best thing. And then all of a sudden, for no reason of your own, the show closes and you're out of a job. Like, no. Sorry to make it sound so stark.
No, it's true. It's the reality.
So in terms of the show, when did you start getting word of it being over? That must have been, or was it pretty quick?
It was fairly quick. The producers were great. They were very generous and they gave us as much notice as they could. And we had a meeting, you know, with them saying, look, it's not looking great. These are the numbers.
That's awful.
So we're not closing now, but I just want you guys to be prepared. Get your stuff in order. Make sure that, you know, you're ready just in case something happens. And then we got our two-week notice.
2 weeks.
A little bit later. You know, and it's interesting to work in that community because people are very experienced. Like my dresser, for instance, you know, she's fabulous. And she's been around the block a million times. She's worked in that theater a lot. And they can smell it in the air, you know, when closing's coming. So he said, you know, I think you guys are going to run till, you know, whatever time.
We get
a bit of an idea from them and from the general community because people have seen shows open and close a million times.
Sure.
I mean, even the guy who was hilarious at the Cosmic Diner on the corner, you know, like even he knew, it seemed more than we did about when the show was going to close, and he had a lot of opinions about it.
He's just reading the tea leaves.
And everybody's really invested, you know, because his business does well if our show does well. So we all want, obviously,
of course,
for it to be successful.
And what was the hardest thing about leaving New York? Did you know where you were going when it was over? So now you get the word you're done.
Oh, yeah. You know what? I did know where I was going.
This is what I'm talking about. You're always on this. That's amazing.
I mean, I have really great agents, too. I mean, my agents are really fabulous. They sent me this script, Gentleman's Guide to Love and Murder that I just finished in California. And they said, you know, and Darko Trejnak was directing. And they sent me the script and they said, look, it's a new show. It's going to be in Hartford. It's a copro between Hartford and the Old Globe. They said, make sure that you love this before you go in. I said, okay, all right. So I read it and I fell in love with it, like head over heels. I have to do this project.
It seems like it was a lot of fun.
I don't care what I do. I'll serve coffee. Like, I don't care what I do with it. It was the same thing with, you know, Lord of the Rings. I just wanted to be part of it. And so I went in and auditioned for Darko, and it was one of these perfect fits. It's just one of these things that happens and you feel it in the moment. And
so, but now I'm one of your cast members who I've got nothing and you're going off and I'm like, damn, I'm in New York all by myself and there goes Chelina.
Well, you know what's important, though?
Go ahead.
It's good to have, this is terrible, but it's good to have a few pots in the fire, you know?
For sure.
And because I've been a singer-songwriter for about 10 years, but I was very shy about it. And near the end of the run, like, I got really involved in my songwriting. And Rick Fox and I,
he up in New York as well?
Yeah, he was up in New York.
Perfect.
And we had talked about recording an album together, and he had said, you know, or him producing my album, and he said, well, we should play live a bunch of times, you know, so we get
the
sound, especially while we're in New York. And so the bravest thing actually I ever did in my whole career was to play the Metropolitan Room in New York City. I mean, I didn't even know if my friends would show up.
Yeah.
But then we sold out.
That's
it was
so
completely
cool.
Sold out. It was a great success. And now we're doing the SpringWorks Festival. But that sort of thing really helped me to get through the closing because I had things to look for.
Perfect.
Or look forward to, and things to work on.
I wonder if the closing hadn't come, if you would have done the gig at the Metropolitan.
I don't know. I would hope that it was something that I'd really been working towards, so I was trying to muster up the courage to do something like that.
Yeah.
Maybe the closing propelled me into it. I'm not sure.
Yeah. And ultimately, then, as the lead, you were a leader in the cast, did you feel you had to be almost like a captain of the ship with the other people and sort of console? Were you, as the lead role, did you feel like to console some of the other folks? I've never been in that kind of environment. Well, I guess I have when stuff's canceled. Y'all just kind of go your own way pretty quick.
Yeah.
There's really not a lot of, it's like, here we go.
No, but I think there is that responsibility because we are a bit like a family.
Sure. Yeah.
And we've been through this, what feels like a bit of a war zone together. I think it wasn't necessarily a responsibility, but it felt like an opportunity for me to step in and say some things.
Yeah.
And I did it with a letter. I wrote a letter to my friends. And it was actually around Tony time because there was so much pressure and there's just so much energy around the Tonys and what that is and the whole concept of awards in a show that feels very dependent on ensemble and on relationship.
Okay. Yeah.
So I think that awards or things of that nature can really tear people apart and ruin something that is quite raw and beautiful. And so I was worried about that potential. So I just wrote to everybody and I said, you know, basically that this was my dream come true, and that I knew it was other people shared that perspective. And whether or not we closed or whether we stayed open or whatever, because we were having some hard times with ticket sales at that time, it didn't matter. The fact that we'd made it that far was a huge success, and a huge success for Canada and for Stratford and for each of us as individuals and for us as a group and for Des, and that we needed to recognize what an achievement it was. Like, even if we do close in 2 weeks, it doesn't matter.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we can't let that take away from the beauty of what this experience has been. And I just felt the need to tell everybody that in a way that was eloquent and not me sort of rambling on with, you know, teary. So I wrote it out in a note and sort of passed it along to everybody.
It sounds really sweet. It sounds like a very sweet thing to do.
I just felt I needed to say it, you know, because I could.
You could feel
it's
it.
So easy to get discouraged when your show that you believe in, you know, either doesn't win the Tony or isn't nominated or whatever it is, or we close even though we got all this attention. I mean, so many things play in a factor.
So now you're going to be in Evangeline at the Charlottetown Festival. Very cool. Now, and you're working with Ted Dykstra.
Yes.
Another great Canadian director.
Yes, I'm a huge fan.
I haven't obviously read, he's written a new play, is that right?
Yes.
Evangeline, it's a new piece of work.
Yeah, and he wrote the music as well.
Based on Longfellow's poem from 1847.
Yes.
The thing reading about the poem itself, because I wasn't familiar with it until I heard about the production, is it's more than a love story, really. And it's an important poem because it helped the Acadians towards an understanding and a garnering recognition about what happened to them and the expulsion, really. So, you know, and the Acadian expulsion is a story of imperialism. It's a story of ideological battles. Again, religion comes in there. Displacement of people. Thousands of people died in the ships leaving that part of the country, and then people died from disease. It's a horrible, horrible story.
Yeah.
And it's but the setting is timeless. It seems like these kind of things happen today. You just have to look to Africa, look to the Middle East, and you know, it's not uncommon that those things sadly are still going on. And your father in his time probably was in some of those places, you know, walking the line and keeping the peace. And tell me a bit about the love story. So it's a love story set in that tumultuous, horrible time.
Yeah. It's a beautiful love story, and it's a story of true bravery, in my opinion, and steadfastness. And she searches her whole life for Gabrielle.
That's it.
He searches his whole life for her, and they don't find each other until the very end.
They get separated during the expulsion.
Yes,
he takes off. She's there.
Yeah, and the saddest part of the whole thing, in my opinion, is how close they come to each other without knowing it. And it is fictional, but there you could just imagine something like this happening in reality, because of course, you know, they didn't have ways of being able to find each other. I mean, how do you go about finding somebody over the course of five states? Or how do you do that
in the 1800s?
In the 1800s, with only a canoe and a few things on your back.
Yeah. So it's an amazing role again. And
it's incredible.
Ted Dykstra said this about the festival's decision to mount the play. This is Ted's words. I'm so very grateful to Confederation Center for having the wisdom and the courage to tell this fantastic story of a maritime woman's fortitude and strength, and of course the resilience of the Acadian people. Mm. Now, do you ever get tired of playing these women with fortitude and strength?
No, I don't. And you know, it's nice to have a comedy thrown in, every once in a while.
That's true. And even at the Charlottetown Festival, you're also doing Anna Green Gables, right? That's a good point, right? Then it was the same thing at Stratford. You got to do a funny thing.
Yeah. And I just come off playing a really, you know, funny role in Guide. So I've had my share of light. Yeah. But now I feel like it's time to go back to something a bit more serious. And this is an important story to tell because of the history, because it's a good Canadian story that we all need to tell our own stories. I mean, we're very good at telling other people's stories, but we need to invest the way that Charlottetown is doing in our own culture. And remembering what this was, it's a great opportunity for me to learn about the Acadian people and about their struggles, and also about my own people, because my own heritage is part...
You're from New Brunswick, right, originally?
Yeah, I was born in New Brunswick, but my mom is part Métis.
Oh, wow.
And so that's, you know, French and Cree. So in learning about her, I'm also learning about my own heritage and the struggles of my own people.
Yeah.
So it's good all around. I think the more we learn about ourselves, the better.
Absolutely. Well, theater is the soul of a nation, and this is a story that really hasn't been... I mean, I got it a bit in history because I was in Quebec, so that was an important part of our learning, but I'm sure there's lots of folks who it's going to be a revelation to them when they see the setting for the beautiful love story. So, but you're also doing Anna Green Gables. Of course, you're not Anne. You get to be Miss Stacy.
I get to be Miss Stacy.
How fun is that?
It's awesome. And apparently somebody told me the other day that they don't know an Anne who has come back to play Miss Stacy. I don't think there has been one. So, you know, it'll be a nice full circle for me to come back and do that.
I believe that. Unflailing, strict about punctuality. Do you remember that scene? That's the that's how she defines herself. She's unflailingly strict about punctuality, Miss Stacy. Which is a, maybe that's the were you when you were the control freak? Was that you?
Oh yeah. Oh yeah.
You'll be again working with a young person like that'll be so cool. Yeah. It'll be so cool to be working with someone who is in the role you were in so many years ago.
Yeah.
And to see that person and nurture them.
Absolutely.
And then one day you're going to be at Stratford and she's going to be the young understudy. You're going to go, oh my God, she's great. Oh my God, I'm getting old. She's great. What am I going to do? Uh-huh. So here, I want to just two more things I want to touch on. Reading about you online, your relationship with your past relationships with men, the men in your lives comes up. And it's, you know, you read about it. I read about it. And I have to question why we're not reading about, you know, Paul Nolan's relationships or why we're not reading about Josh Young's relationship. How does that, how do you feel about that whole world? Or what would, you know, your mother, a feminist, feel about the fact that, that women are still in that, in the theater, well, everywhere really. I mean, you get it in politics too. People are talking about Andrea Horvath's dress or, you know, or Kathleen Wynne's glasses, you know, when people never make comments about Dalton McGuinty's tie. It's kind of, it's just, what do you think about all that? You know? How do you deal with it? I mean, that's got to be grating.
It was for a while. I mean, I think that people are less curious about it now than they were before. I don't know why the fascination with relationships. I really don't. Yeah. There was for a couple of years quite an interest in knowing a lot about, you know, my personal life. Yeah. And I just couldn't figure out why it was so interesting. I mean, I guess maybe because the people I've been associated with are interesting people. And they, I don't know. I mean, eventually I sort of just realized that it was better to keep it out of the conversation entirely. Just because there's enough pressure on,
of course,
on me and on relationships as it is to not have to talk about it in the media. So
yeah, and I just think it's, and it dawned on me when I was doing the background research that I'm not reading these stories about the men.
Yeah.
I can't tell you any guy at Stratford who's dating who.
It's ironic, isn't it? I know. No one really talks about it. But yet, we have sort of hounded for it. Funny enough, you'd think, well, who cares?
Yeah,
you know? But,
yeah.
But a couple people really did
pick up on it and really were interested. Yeah,
that story.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's sort of too bad. I think it's too bad anyway. Anyway, so we don't have to talk about it. I'm just curious how you cope with that sort of
thing. Well, I try not to let any of those things really bother me too much. Because, I mean, ultimately, it's all sort of my experience. So it doesn't... Yeah, it doesn't. It is what it is,
right.
You know. So ultimately, you can't let it sort of drive you nuts.
So on your website, you've got the category interests.
Yes,
which I think is so cool because it adds so much depth. And there's some books that I enjoy as well. Fast Food Nation's there, and that's sort of part of my world as well. And tell me about your choice. Well, it's interesting in light of the other part of that conversation about because that is part of your personal life that you are interested in sharing with people.
Yes. Well, I think it's an important one to share. I mean, you know, I don't want to be sort of a political person who tries to push their views on people. But, you know, I think like anything that you're passionate about, whether it's the arts or it's about, you know, the pork industry in Manitoba or whether it's about commercial food in general or the environment, I think it's great to at least have a conversation about it when you can. Because I think, well, for me, when I was growing up, I had two directions. All I ever wanted to do, I said earlier in the conversation, was to perform.
Be on stage, yeah.
But my other passion was animal rights and the environment. And I was writing letters to the newspaper when I was a 6-year-old about littering and about vivisection and all sorts of things. So, you know, I became an activist in my earlier life and then I got quite discouraged. And so I stopped and just became, you know, tried to just sort of be the change that you want to see in the world, that quote. I left it at that. And then more recently I thought, well, I think I have a bit of a responsibility as somebody who maybe draws a little bit of attention that I can share some of these things without being preachy about it. I can just maybe introduce some of these ideas to people who may not otherwise think about it or may not know about some of these things. Yeah. Because we have an opportunity to create a little bit of change.
Yeah, yeah.
So why not do it, you know?
Yeah, no, I'm on board. I'm just looking at Michael Pollan's book, Cooked, which is his latest book. And he say it kind of drives you nuts when someone of that, you know, magnitude says something you've been saying for a long time. Like, food is the most political choice you can make. You know?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
On a day-to-day level, it's just such an easy way to say, okay, I don't believe in this. I do believe in this. And this is what's important to me. You know?
Yeah, yeah. And it's the most important thing that we put in our bodies.
Of course.
I mean, it's the, it's, you are what you eat. You actually are what you
eat. And what you eat is what's around you, ultimately. So going back to Manitoba pork producers, do you want factory farms and, you know, trucks with pigs being slaughtered, or do you want, you know, that's the nice thing about Stratford, actually, is the food movement out there.
This, yes, you know, it's fabulous.
It is amazing. There's, you know, you get local food, farm-to-table restaurants and people who care about the way they bring up their animals or raise their animals. Mm-hmm. Do you eat meat? Are you a meat eater?
I have become a meat eater for health issues. Well, it's interesting because I was a vegetarian for a long time, but I was so anemic because of the way that my body absorbs iron that even my naturopath said, you have to start eating meat. You're not going to be able to get out of this if you don't. And so I started to try to turn to ethical sources of meat.
Sure.
You know, ethical meaning gently introduced into the food chain is sort of what I'm after. And you can find it. I mean, people really are conscious about it nowadays. And so I figured also, you know, if you're giving your dollars to farmers who have great practices, that's probably better than not giving your dollars to anybody at all. You know,
So
I like to support those local farmers who are doing.
Yeah, no, there's a lot of that in Stratford. How was that in New York?
You know what? It was easier than I thought.
Okay.
Yeah. There, especially, I lived on the Upper West Side. I was very fortunate, but there are lots of you know vegan places and you know, organic meat places around there.
What's your go-to meal?
Ooh, go-to meal. Well, it used for a while. It was liver and onions, if you can believe that, because I was so anemic.
Like, how long did that last?
Well, all during my Evita year, I was quite weak.
Okay.
So I used to eat liver all the time.
For sure. And now, were you getting it from now, there's not many. I don't think there's many organic meat farmers out there, but they would be sort of pesticide free and were you able to get organic?
I was able to get organic at the Gentle Rain. There's a great little place in Stratford called the Gentle Rain. So
did
I would
you
go
enjoy
there.
It? I like my, you know, when my mom made liver, I hated it. And then the first time I went to a French restaurant and I had a liver, I was like, this is amazing.
Oh my gosh. If it's cooked right, it is unbelievable. My dad flambés it in brandy and he does this whole thing.
He didn't talk about the alcohol part.
No, it's fabulous. Add alcohol to anything, it makes it better.
So that was your go-to meal for a while. And now?
Yeah. Now it's sort of, I tend to graze. Like I still try to eat vegetarian.
In terms of cooking.
Oh God, I make this really good, it's from my mom's recipes, but the sort of stewed beef with onions and potatoes and, you know, with nothing else. It's just kind of like a very thick stew.
Real simple, and just put it on the pot and let it go.
That's how
I like cooking. I like sticking something in the oven, let it sit for an hour and a half, or stick it on the stove and let it sit and like just walk away.
Yeah.
And there you go. I'll give you a recipe for braised short ribs. It's so good.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah,
I would love that.
Short ribs are so good.
Also too, just another thing, because I love the documentary Food Matters. But ever since I watched that, I'm trying to eat 51% of my meal raw.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to eat a lot more raw food because I do love, you know, in the wintertime, especially having all these stews.
I haven't seen Food Matters. I saw Food Inc. Did you see Food Inc.? I was disappointed with Food Inc.
Oh, I didn't see that one.
Yeah, it's all right. You don't need to see it.
Food Matters is pretty fabulous. Okay. It changed my life.
Wow.
Loved it. I've introduced it to everybody.
I'll check it out.
Yeah, it's good.
Well, that's a good way to end. Thank you so much for that. Thanks so much for taking the time. Have so much fun in Charlottetown.
Thank you.
And when are we going to see you? Because, you know, it's the Stratford thing that you've developed this audience there. When are you going to be back?
I would love to be back as soon as I can.
Okay.
I was having a little FOMO, fear of missing out this year, because, you know, it was there's so many great people going back, and I can't wait to go and see the shows there, but hopefully very soon.
Good. All right. Thanks, Jelena.
Thank you.
Well, hey, there you go. Who knew? An interview that started out talking about an army brat who became a musical theater performer extraordinaire would end up talking about liver and braised ribs. How cool is that? I'll post a link to the braised. It's a great recipe. I go to the Mennonites. I get the beef from them. No hormones, antibiotics. And I just cook it up. The recipe, I think the recipe I post calls for Coca-Cola, but I'm not a Coke guy. So I just add my own vanilla, beautiful fresh vanilla, and a little bit of honey, you know. Anyway, thanks so much for listening. As always, try to visit StratfordTeaLeaves.com. And keep the faith, keep the creative process going. It never is a perfect experience unless you go back and forth, and don't let the times you fail, don't let the times things don't work out exactly like you expected to bring you down. As one buddy of mine said to me, success in this business is getting up one more time that you've been knocked down. It's Keith Tomasek. You're listening to The Inadequate Life, a podcast about the creative process and the people whose lives depend upon it. See you next time.